It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll talk to the country's first female four-star general about the leadership lessons she learned while serving. First, as the Wisconsin State Legislature's Budget Writing Committee gets ready to take up funding cuts for the University of Wisconsin system, the state finds itself bucking a national trend. According to our next guest, Wisconsin is one of only six states that have approved or are considering cuts to higher education funding for the coming fiscal year. The UW system faces a proposed $300 million cut over the next 2 years. Joining us now is Karen Herzog, who covers higher education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So as we said, Wisconsin, one of six states that have approved or are considering cuts to higher education funding. What other states are on that list?
Well, the other states include four states with Republican governors. That would be Arizona, Illinois, and Louisiana, in addition to Wisconsin. And then two with Democratic governors. That would be Connecticut and West Virginia.
And in your recent piece, you take a look at where education funding is in Wisconsin compared with our Midwest neighbors and also nationally. Where are we in that big picture?
Well, when you look at the Midwest, Wisconsin, by many measures, lags in higher education spending. Wisconsin spends about $10,000 less per four-year degree granted than other states, and that would include like money that's put behind instructional costs, academic support, student services. And the significance of that is that, you know, that universities have to make up for the money that they don't get from state funding when it's cut by raising tuition or cutting back their expenses. And tuition increases are a really big concern, although it appears that there will be a tuition freeze, continuation of the current freeze for the next 2 years for resident undergraduate students.
Which Midwestern state spends the most on education?
Interestingly, it's Iowa. Iowa spends the most pretty much by most measures. And Wisconsin, when you look at it as a national comparison, Wisconsin is kind of below the average, too, in those measures. Interestingly, though, when you talk about other states that are considering significant higher education cuts, Wisconsin may end up being the state with the largest cut to higher education in the whole country once things settle, because lawmakers and Governor Walker have indicated no interest in raising taxes to offset the cuts. In fact, Governor Walker has pledged not to raise taxes. He seems pretty adamant about that. So it's going to be interesting if they are able to reduce the cuts, where they will find the money to do that.
Well, let's look at those other six states and where Wisconsin fits in. Among those states who are looking at cutting funding to higher education, how much are they proposing to cut compared to Wisconsin?
Well, Louisiana and Illinois are the other two states that are looking at nine-figure increases. Louisiana was the highest to begin with, although it looks like with a combination of tax credits being rolled back and tax increases that they're going to really cut it significantly. They were looking at about $600 million. The second highest was Illinois, and that's about $400 million. $209 million of that going just to the University of Illinois campuses. And there also is some discussion there about increasing taxes, maybe reordering some of their priorities and spending. The Democrats have been adamant that they don't want to cut higher education by the $400 million that the governor has proposed there. Now, of course, Wisconsin does $150 million per year of this next biennium. It's still up there, and if those cuts aren't reduced and the other states do reduce them, again, Wisconsin can end up being the state with the highest cut.
So you think if things change in these other states, Wisconsin would be the only state left with a nine-figure cut?
It's possible. Arizona, the cut there was $99 million, so it's pretty close to $100 million for this next fiscal year. It's hard to say how this is all going to shake out, and Wisconsin lawmakers really haven't indicated. Joint Finance Committee takes this up tomorrow. There really hasn't been any indication of where they might be able to find the money, even though they have expressed a desire to reduce the cut.
We're talking right now with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Karen Herzog. We're talking about Wisconsin's status right now as one of six states eyeing cuts to higher education. And Karen, you look at also the per household support for higher education in Wisconsin and how that's changed. What have you seen there?
That's one of the most interesting statistics that I've seen recently, and I had not seen this before. The Pell Institute for the Study of Opportunity in Higher Education put out some numbers earlier this year, and it looked at state by state how much per $1,000 personal income was spent on higher education in terms of tax dollars. In the early 70s, Wisconsin really supported higher education in terms of the amount of money that was put toward it. The average household income back then was $15,000. And when you look at the numbers and figure inflation, Wisconsin taxpayers were paying about five times more than they currently are toward higher education.
And that's adjusting for inflation.
Exactly.
Now, in your piece, you reference a representative for the American Association of State Colleges and Universities who's looking at situations where states are eyeing cuts like Wisconsin is. What questions did he say funding cuts to higher education brings up to him?
Well, he said you have to look at the political environment in states that are considering education cuts, because if you think about what drives the economy, college graduates tend to be the ones who are required for the knowledge-based economy. And so you want to look at what's the political environment, of course, taxes, whether the willingness or unwillingness to raise taxes typically is the major equation there. And then also whether this reflects the will of the people. Do state residents support cutting that much in higher education? And in Wisconsin, there have been two polls in the last month that indicate that Wisconsin residents do not support $300 million in cuts over the next 2 years. In fact, one of them was by a 70% vote, and the other was by a 64% margin.
Now, we're talking about how Wisconsin is only one of six states who is looking to cut higher education. We're just seemingly coming out of the tail end, we hope, of the Great Recession. Are we seeing other states doing not just, you know, flat funding for education, but the reverse? Are we seeing funding restored in many other states?
Yes, we are. In fact, our next-door neighbor, Minnesota, raised taxes with part of that new revenue set aside for higher education. And if you look at Minnesota versus Wisconsin, that's a very common comparison. 32% of Minnesota residents have a college degree versus like 26% in Wisconsin. Minnesota tends to spend a lot more state support toward higher education than Wisconsin does.
Now, the governor and state lawmakers are committed to keeping tuition frozen for in-state students for this budget cycle, at least, possibly longer. Has the university ever been in a position like this where it has faced cuts to its budget without the power to raise resident tuition?
Well, this is the largest cut proposed in the past 10 years in Wisconsin. And that's according to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau and all other biennia except 2013-15, the regents had the authority to increase resident undergraduate tuition to offset some of those cuts. And in the past, they did do that. There were significant tuition increases over the last several years when there were cuts in state funding. However, that's not an option anymore, and that's why we're looking at some pretty deep cuts within the UW system campuses.
What percentage of the university's total operating budget comes from the state?
It's about 19%, and then that percentage has changed. It used to be significantly higher, and tuition used to be significantly lower in terms of a percentage of the operating budget. And that has flipped, and obviously student loan debt has gone up as tuition has been increasing.
And do we have a sense about that 19%, how significant it is to the university?
You know, some people will say, well, gee, it's just, you know, that the funding cut, and this is something the governor's office says, the funding cut, the $300 million over 2 years, it's just really, or $150 per year, is just 2.5% of the total budget. It's a 2.5% cut. However, that's not the way to look at it if you're talking about impact. Really, when you look at the impact, it's about a 6% cut overall to to the UW system's budget, because a lot of the money that they have is restricted. They can't use it to fill any holes that are created by a budget cut. So it is a significant source of income.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about Wisconsin's status as one of the few states eyeing cuts to higher education. Well, today is kind of a special day. It is the birthday of the creator of one of the most famous fictional characters of all times. He seems to be sort of immortal. He just goes on and on, talking here, of course, about James Bond and his creator, Ian Fleming. And Chris Molina is here in the studio with me. Chris, you're a fan.
Yeah, Veronica, I'm a huge fan of James Bond. And actually, I started reading the books a couple of years ago, and I picked up Casino Royale, and I was kind of addicted to it because I really liked the movies. And, you know, what was interesting to me is the James Bond that you see in the books is a completely different James Bond than what you see on the big screen. The James Bond in the books, he's dark, he's brooding, you know, he says very nasty things to women, you know, he's not the sly-talking, you know, guy, you know, the slick secret agent.
And that's the one you like better. You like the dark and brooding.
I like them both in their own ways. They're different enough from the movies. I kind of do, you know, like the variety of seeing both. You know, and I would say that, like, the new movies that are out now, like The Skyfalls and The Casino Royale, that's kind of more of like the James Bond that you used to see in the books.
And we want to know, on this occasion, Ian Fleming's birthday, the creator of James Bond, we want to know who your favorite fictional character is. If you could invite someone out from the pages of a book or from a movie, who would it be? If you want to go have a drink with them, catch some dinner, chit-chat, call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us who it is that you really just wish was your BFF that you could hang out with.
Well, let's start with you, Veronica. I mean, do you have a fictional character who you'd like to go out to Starbucks or something with?
Well, I mean, it's hard not to want to go out to Starbucks with Dumbledore.
Of course.
From Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And right now, I'm really engrossed in the Scandinavian books about this guy telling his life story. This is a real guy, though, but he's from the pages, you know, Knausgard.
Hmm.
And a brooding Norwegian, much like your brooding James Bond. But
yes.
I would love to know what Dumbledore would order.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to see what kind of magic that he could work on a latte or something like that. Hey, we want to hear from you, too. We're talking about your favorite fictional characters of all time. Give us a call with your idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or go ahead and post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right. And we're going to go first to Ellen, who's joining us in Waupun. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. I just happened to be turning on the radio, and I heard you asking about a favorite character. And for me, it would be Father Tim in the Mitford series by Jan Karen.
Father Tim. Okay, I don't know anything about that. Tell us a little bit about Father Tim.
Oh, he's just a delightful person. He's in his late 60s, 70s at the beginning of the series, and he finds his love of his life, first-time marriage for him, and all of the foibles of a small-town pastor. It's just very heartwarming and has a great deal of spiritual truth in it, and I just really love Jan Karen's writing style.
Ah, that's a beautiful one. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for calling in, Ellen. And we have an open line for you right now at 800-642-1234 on this, the birthday of Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. We want to know what favorite fictional character you would like to hang out with. Who really would you like to sit down and have a talk with? Maybe just have some jokes, but maybe get into the philosophy, the deep stuff. And we're going to go next to Amy in Abram, Wisconsin. Amy, hi.
Hi. My all-time favorite character, I would love to meet Leslie Knope from the TV show Parks and Recreation.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. What would you do with Amy? With Leslie?
Oh, anything, really. I think just spending time with her would be just amazing. She's just so positive and energetic, and she just sees the world in such an amazing way that I just think it would just be amazing just to spend time with her.
A woman role model. I like it. All right, Amy, thank you so much for that. We appreciate that call. 800-642-1234. 1234 is the number to call.
And, you know, Amy brought up Leslie Knope, and I guess I hadn't been thinking about TV too much. And, the show that I've been watching a lot recently is, I'm sure you have, Veronica, is Game of Thrones. I think those are characters who I would not like to hang out with in real life. I'd be scared for my safety and the safety of those around me. But a lot of interesting options once you do start to think about TV. I mean, are there any TV shows, Veronica, that you've been watching that you could think of with, you know, maybe a character who you really like, who you think, you know what, I could really hang out with this person?
You know, in a similar vein, I've been really into the Sherlock series on PBS, played by Benedict Cumberbatch. But then I thought, I don't want to hang out with him. He seems like he'd be kind of a drag. Maybe Watson.
There seems to be a lot of people. Well, you know, it depends if we're talking about Sherlock or if we're talking about Benedict Cumberbatch, because I know there are a lot of people out there that are huge fans of Benedict Cumberbatch. I guess I just don't know much about him, but Sherlock would be cool. I mean, you know, like, I lose my keys like every other day, and if I had someone like Sherlock around, man, like, life would be so much easier.
Let's go back to our phones now. We have Dublin on the line in Shawnee, Wisconsin. Hi there.
Hello.
What is your vote?
I picked Arya Stark from Game of Thrones.
That's a good one. And Chris, that's actually a character that maybe you would want to hang out with.
I was going to say, if I had to hang out with anyone from Game of Thrones, it would probably be Arya, just because she's tough. She knows what she's doing. She's still alive, as far as I know.
Yeah, she's a fierce one, though, Dublin. What do you like about her?
I like that she's courageous and awesome and not afraid to fight.
Courageous and awesome. That says it all. She really is.
Yeah, that's some good words of motivation right there. Thank you so much, Dublin, for the call.
All right, and you can reach us with your thought about who you'd like to leap out of the pages of your favorite book, your favorite novel, who you'd like to spend some hang time with, really get to know in real life, your BFF from fiction. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we're going to go next to Troy in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Troy.
Hi. My favorite character is Harry Bosch. And I made a mistake when I told your phone answer. It's a Michael Conley book.
Okay.
He is a detective.
Harry Bosch. All right, tell us about Harry Bosch.
He's a cop out in L.A. He works on homicides. And he gets in trouble with the police department, as well as solving his case all the time. So it's really good books.
Gotcha. All right, Harry Bosch, the detective. And again, we're getting the detective theme here.
Getting a lot of detectives. Yeah, there's definitely that need out there, I'm sensing, for people to come in and solve those problems. You know, we also, I'm looking up at our screen here, Jennifer, who's answering your phone calls, typed, "I'd really like to meet the guy from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy." You know, I'm not sure which guy she's talking about, but there's not a bad choice in that roster. If you've ever read The Hitchhiker Guide, you know, one of the many books, or seen the movies or the TV shows, and I know we talked about that on the show a little bit the other day, but man, that is an entertaining cast of characters right there. And yeah, a wild group if you want to travel the galaxy.
That is a great suggestion. And I was thinking about detectives. Walt Longmire from the Longmire Mysteries, as long as we're sticking with detectives here and people of intrigue who solve crimes.
That's one that just went right over my head.
You need to read these books. They're very good.
Okay.
Anyway, he's a laid back, I think it's Montana or is it Wyoming? See, I haven't read one in a while, but detective who solves crimes in a laid back fashion. Seems like a fun guy to hang out with. We're going to go next to Paula in Burlington. Hello, Paula. You're on the air.
Hi. If I had a character I'd like to meet, it would be Crazy Eyes from Orange is the New Black. And I'm not sure if it's the actress or the character, because I think they're both equally fascinating.
Crazy Eyes is a fascinating character. What is it about Crazy Eyes that you'd really like to meet her?
I think it's her vulnerability that it comes through so clearly on the show, and there's so much behind that I would like to find out how to support her and make her feel better.
And Paula, I know that the new season is coming out of Orange is the New Black pretty soon. Are you excited for the season to start?
Oh, I am indeed.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that call, Paula. And Chris, tell me who Crazy Eyes is. I haven't watched the whole series.
She's one of the characters who you meet kind of early on, who sort of, you know, affectionately introduces herself to Piper, the main character, and they sort of have this complex relationship. And, you know, when you first meet Crazy Eyes, which isn't even her name, it's kind of her prison nickname that she picks up, you know, you kind of figure out that she has a sort of this tragic past, and which kind of explains some of her behavior. And that's what that show does really well. You get into some, you know, you see these characters, and then you have the flashbacks. you kind of understand, you know, why they are the way they are. And yeah, I'm excited to see where the story goes.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for that one. Appreciate it. We're going to go next to Linda in McHenry. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love Lucas Davenport from John Sanford books, the Prey series. There's been, I don't even know how many, but they take place in the Twin Cities, and Lucas also has a home in Hayward that he goes to, and very, very great character development over the series.
Lucas Davenport. Chris, have you heard of Lucas Davenport?
That's not one that I've heard of. I'll have to look into that when we get off the air. All these great suggestions here today.
Definitely worth looking into, because there is something about these characters when they're really fully fleshed out. And you know when it's good when you finish a book and you just have this longing to keep being with that person, with that character.
And that's why I love series of books, because, you know, your book will end, and if, you know, it's a series that kind of goes in a certain order, you get to pick up right where you left off with those characters, and it's sad to see them go eventually.
Well, thank you so much for all your suggestions. Remember, you can keep this conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know which character you would like to be your real-life BFF. Only one problem, they're fictional. They're in a book. They're on TV or in a movie. Let us know at the Central Time Facebook page. The gridlock in Washington isn't just derailing legislation, it's diverting seemingly an entire generation of future leaders away from politics. A recent national survey of more than 4,000 college and high school students finds that the vast majority of young people see Washington as broken and its political leaders as self-interested. Considering that the current U.S. political system relies on more than 500,000 elected officials, this trend might pose a concern. How will America sustain its democracy if its prospective leaders simply don't want to run for office? With us now is Jennifer Lawless. She's the author of the book Running from Office. She joins us from American University, where she's a professor of government and the author of Running from Office. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Jennifer, why should we be concerned with the question of whether or not the millennial generation, young Americans, are likely to get involved in politics, to run for office?
Well, the question is important not only because we have 500,000 elective offices in this country and democracy can only sustain itself if people are interested in seeking them, but also because the disgust, disdain, and disinterest that we uncovered are really quite remarkable. 89% of young people today, 13 to 25-year-olds, have already written off the idea of ever running.
As we know, people's attitudes change, people mature. How do we know that how they feel right now will actually be their attitude 5 years, 10 years from now?
Well, there are a couple of reasons that we're pretty confident that these results will hold. The first is that studies in other disciplines have found convincing evidence to show that the kinds of careers and the kinds of hobbies and interests that people pursue when they're in their late teens and early 20s often map on to what they do later in life. The second reason is that Richard Fox and I, who wrote this book, have also done surveys over the course of the last 15 years of potential candidates. So these are adults who work in the professions that are most likely to lead to political careers. And over the course of those 15 years, we've surveyed some of the same people, and their general interest in office has not changed.
Now, you surveyed 4,000 high school and college students about this. In general, what did you find?
Well, we found that about 9 out of 10 are not interested in running for any office in the future, that they'd rather do almost anything else, and that their attitudes are linked very much to what they see in Washington right now as inefficiency, gridlock, stalemate, and obstructionism.
And looking at those numbers, did this break down into demographic trends that you could see?
Overall, regardless of race, gender, location, socioeconomic status, the overwhelming majority of young people have no interest in running for office. The one major demographic difference that we did uncover had to do with the college students. And there we uncovered a very substantial gender gap in political ambition. So whereas high school girls and boys were roughly equally likely, or I guess it would be better to say unlikely, to be interested in pursuing a political candidacy later in life, once they stepped foot on a college campus, women's ambitions stayed pretty flat, and men's shot through the roof.
Hmm. And what do you put that down to?
Well, it's difficult to know, but it seems that it might be that when you go to college, you have independence over how you spend your time, what you talk about with your friends, what classes you take, how you pursue your career interests. And so in high school, one of the major goals that people have is getting into college. So they want to present themselves as very well-rounded, and they have incentives to pursue the same kinds of extracurricular activities, take the same kinds of classes, volunteer in the same kinds of places. Once they get to college, that's no longer the case. And so it may be that women and men migrate to activities that they actually prefer.
Now, if we were to take a snapshot of the last, let's say, 5, 10, 15 years of what American politics has been through, are there specific incidents that you can point to and say these are the kinds of things or the specific things that have seemingly turned off this generation from politics?
We didn't ask in the survey itself about specifics, but we did do hour-long phone interviews with about 115 of the survey respondents. And there, they often mention specific examples to shed light on this. Many mentioned that the first time they remember being exposed to a politician, it was a president who was lying. For some of them, that was Bill Clinton when he was lying about Monica Lewinsky during the impeachment scandal. For others, it was George Bush when they said that he was lying about having weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And that sort of lying, disinterested, willing to try and pull a fast one with the American people kind of logic stuck with these young people. They also referenced several of the high-profile sex scandals we've seen in the recent years. John Edwards is just one example. And the government shutdown is just the most obvious of the examples that we can point to now. That actually occurred after we did the interviews. But, you know, this is a situation where if people thought that Washington was unresponsive in the first place, we then had furloughed workers, disgruntled tourists, people that couldn't access clinical trials. And, you know, that just reinforces the idea that if you want to get something done, elective office is not the way to do it.
And aside from those possible specific examples of things that can turn people away from politics, young Americans in particular we're talking about here, another factor that you identify is that young people don't seem to grow up talking about politics in the home anymore and engaging from that young age. What did they tell you about politics in the home?
That's exactly right. We asked them how often they talked to their parents about politics, and only about a quarter said that they had regular conversations with their parents. 50% said that they never talked to either their mothers or their fathers about politics at all. We also asked about politics at mealtime, whether their parents ever get angry or engaged enough that they'll yell at the television, for example, and those numbers were very low. In addition, we asked whether they had ever engaged in any kind of political activity with their parents, whether they voted with their parents, whether they watched election coverage. And the numbers for election coverage and going to vote with their parents were a little bit higher. They were about a third, but that's where civic engagement ended. And so what we saw was a pattern whereby the majority of American families just don't talk about this at all. And then the ones who do tend to talk about the most negative, inefficient aspects of it. And so even in those cases, we have young people exposed not to any kind of sense that politics could be a noble profession, but rather that politics might not be the best use of their time.
Why do you think that it is that people seem to be turning away from, you know, those dinner table conversations within the family about politics that seem like they may have been more common a generation or two ago?
Right. They did used to be more common. I think it's a couple of things. The first is that we now have a 24-hour news cycle and a social media environment whereby it's very, very easy with very little work to come up with a long list of the most egregious things that any politician did on any given day. And so I think that the idea that politics is noble is just very easy to refute by simply turning on the news. The second thing is that with increased party polarization, we really don't have moderates anymore. So politics is probably more divisive and more argumentative than it's been in the past. And what a lot of these young people told us time and again was that they just didn't want to fight. They didn't want to fight with their parents. They didn't want to have arguments with their friends. And avoiding politics seemed to be the best way to do that.
And speaking of arguments with friends, it was, I don't know, kind of startling to me that you asked, do you have conversations about politics with your friends? And the people you talked to, the young people, seemed like, no, why would I do that?
Right. they basically said that they would rather talk about anything else. We asked them on the survey what types of things they did talk about with their friends, and school and their classes was obviously at the top of the list, but every other category trumped politics, whether it be movies, food, celebrities, sports. All of the other topics were far more important. And when we delved a little bit more deeply in the phone interviews with these kids and asked why that was, something that came up time and again was this idea that there's no way to have a civil conversation about these issues, because when they look at the television set or when they look at the internet or if they happen to read a newspaper, all of the political discussion is framed as pitting one side against another. And so the idea that a political conversation could actually involve well-thought-out debate and deliberation just seemed completely obscure to them.
And this gets at another overarching theme you saw here that may be responsible for what's going on. You say that young Americans, millennials, are disconnected politically, and that goes down to the amount of news that they might consume in a day.
Right. We found that when we asked about their news habits and when we asked about the sources where they got their news, they made it very, very clear that they are just not interested in seeking out political information. They're not particularly interested in identifying the most important topics of the day. They're not interested in talking about these topics with their families or their friends, and rarely are they interested in gathering more information about politics and current events on their own. But it's the same underpinning that causes this kind of knee-jerk reaction to being turned off to it, and that's that when they are exposed to political news, they find it very depressing, they find it generally disillusioning, and they just feel like it's not a good use of their time. They feel like it's happening a million miles away.
How has that changed compared with generations that came before?
Overall exposure and interest in the news, family discussions, and discussions with classmates are significantly lower now than they were if we look at people who grew up in the 70s and the 80s. We don't know about people's levels of interest in running for office in previous points in time. As far as we know, this is the first national survey of that question. But we do know that families, friends, and the media are the kinds of factors that generate interest in running for office. So if we know that now those levels are lower than they've been in the past, we have pretty suggestive evidence that ambition is lower now than it was before as well.
We're looking right now at why some new evidence suggests that young people don't seem to be interested in running for political office. And we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you a young person, a millennial, who's considered running for office? If not, what's holding young people back from wanting political careers? If you're in this group of younger Americans, did you grow up talking about politics, maybe around the dinner table with your family? What's your opinion of how Washington is doing, and does it affect whether or not you might get involved in politics yourself? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the increasing tendency for young people to steer clear of politics and political careers, and we want to hear your voice on this. Why do you think young people are increasingly disengaged from politics and disinterested in running for office? And what would it take for the nation's youngest and brightest to re-engage in that political arena? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jennifer Lawless stays with us. She's professor of government at American University and the author of the new book, Running from Office. And we're going to go to our callers now. Anna joins us in Neenah. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I just wanted to call to say I'm a young person. I'm in my mid-20s. And a lot of my friends who don't vote say that they just feel like there's too much to fix. And it discourages them because they feel like their voice won't ever be heard. And I don't like to talk to them about it because all we do is argue and they won't vote. So we don't talk about it either.
Anna, thank you so much. I appreciate your voice and you calling and sharing that. Anna seems to reflect exactly what you're talking about, and also the sense that there's too much to tackle there. What do you think, Jennifer?
That's exactly right. Anna sounds just like the people that we interviewed. There was one woman, for example, who was a college student, and she told us that every time she brings up politics, her friends are demonstrating that they're not engaged, and that makes her angry because she feels like they should be wanting to change the system, and as a result, she's just decided that it's safer not to talk about it at all. Others told us that the minute they would get into a conversation about it, it would just seem like it was so daunting to even begin to think about how to improve Washington that they decided not to have those conversations anymore either. So for a long time, political scientists, pundits, scholars thought that young Americans were just disinterested in politics and tuned out. But the argument that we're making is not that they're tuned out because they're disinterested. They're tuned out because they're turned off.
And it's worth pointing out here that just because millennials aren't interested in running for office doesn't mean they don't care about the world. It seems as though you found a lot of these same people did volunteer and did want to make the world a better place, just not from a position of politics.
That's exactly right. These were not people who were disinterested in their communities or their states or their country or the globe. Many had very, very high aspirations for improving society in general. And they, more than 50% volunteered in the community. Many believed that they would ultimately go into some kind of public service profession. But what's different about this generation than previous generations is that they don't consider running for office a form of public service.
Anna, thanks a lot for the call. We're going to go next to Chris. Chris joins us in Madison. Hi there.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was interested in running for office. In fact, the old salts at my first full-time job used to call me congressman because I had talked about it. But I volunteered for campaigns and really got turned off by two things. One is that lack of professional discourse, civil discourse. I'm extremely conservative, but get most of my news from public radio, and you can't have just a discussion without somebody being feeling personally attacked. The other thing is that at any level of significance in elected office, you spend 80-90% of your time fundraising. And that my idea was is that I wanted to get into politics to help people by getting the government off its back, off the people's back. But you can't do that when you're spending 80% of your time begging for money.
Chris, great. A lot of good points there. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your thoughts. Chris pointing at the extreme partisanship, the era that we're living through right now, and also at the amount of time candidates have to spend fundraising. How much did that come up, Jennifer?
Fundraising didn't come up that often, I think because for many of these young people, the question was more abstract. It was more about, would you ever consider doing this at all? And they had such visceral reactions to the notion of even getting involved in the system that the mechanics involved in running a campaign were not even on their minds. But the one thing that I would add to that is, the kinds of offices that Chris just spoke about are federal offices. So Congress, whether it be the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate, certainly demand that their members spend an incredible amount of time raising money. The average congressional race now costs well over $1 million. But there are only 537 federal offices across the country. There are more than 500,000 elected offices, though. So millions and millions of offices are at the local and state level. Many of them are nonpartisan, and many of them don't actually involve onerous fundraising demands at all. But we tend to assess the political arena through this national lens, and we're concerned because young people are writing off the idea of running for office based on things that they don't like about Washington, when the reality is there are hundreds of thousands of offices that are nowhere near Washington where they could really affect change.
And Jennifer, you don't just talk about the issue at hand. You talk about solutions, too. What do you see as some possible solutions to getting people reengaged?
We tried to be realistic in our solutions because the obvious ones would be to tell members of Congress to behave better or to tell the media not to report on only the bad behavior. But we know that that is not going to be a likely outcome. So instead, we tried to focus on solutions that would incentivize young people to get involved. One of them, for example, is to link political aptitude to the college admissions process. Right now, it's possible to apply to and be admitted to a top university knowing virtually nothing about politics or current events. If we were able to link some degree of political aptitude to the admissions process, that would incentivize young people to follow what's going on. If they follow what's going on, sure, they'll be exposed to some negative things, but chances are they'll also happen upon some policy successes, some inspirational politicians along the way, and that could generate interest. We know, for example, that young people's interest in volunteering skyrocketed when college admissions officers made it clear that they were looking for high school students to volunteer and to demonstrate that on their applications. So that's just one way that we could generate broader interest in politics and increase exposure so that young people are seeing not only the negative, but also some of the positive.
And you're also talking some high-tech solutions, things like apps and video games. How would that work?
We are. As far as the app is concerned, we've thought about an app where you could actually access all of the elected offices that are available to you based on your address. Right now, there's no clearinghouse. There are 500,000 offices, but it's difficult to know which ones apply in which locations. We don't know what the qualifications are for all of them or what the responsibilities are. But young people are so accustomed to being able to find everything out by just touching a screen that if we could develop an app where somebody could enter their address and see all of the different options they have for getting involved in politics, they would realize that there are many, many offices out there that might actually match up to their interests and that might actually be located in a place that they find appealing. Right now, that information is very, very difficult to get, and you have to be very entrepreneurial to collect it in any kind of systematic way. The other is video games. There are incredibly sophisticated graphics in many video games that have to deal with war or building cities or being entrepreneurs. No such video games exist in that kind of quality for politics. Yet you can imagine young people getting pretty addicted to a situation where they have to run a candidate's campaign or they have to debate a candidate or they have to get a bill through Congress. And I don't think that we've fully taken advantage of the technology that could make that fun and engaging.
And we leave it there. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jennifer Lawless, professor of government and director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. She's the author of the new book, Running from Office.